The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Joe versus the political volcano. Watch out for the Dilbert date. Mark works hundreds of cases and gets comfortable with testifying. ELN ends out the year and starts a new one with AI, games, and pitchers. More fraud, spies, and lies for the holiday season. Breaking news, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The information warfare is heating up over the Gaza Strip. False claims about historical facts are driving crowds worldwide toward hatred of Israel and Jews. Videos are being relabeled within a few hours to make false claims to counter truthful ones. And the news media is missing the obvious truths and paying attention to the headline grabbers. And that's breaking news on The Cyber Show.
A lot of our discussions get cut from the show for time or irrelevance to the subject of the rest of the discussion. In this segment, we replay a conversation between Chris and Fred.
As always, there's the old versus the new. You know, and, Samuel Coleridge, who wrote Xanadu, you know, everybody knows him for that, you know, was apparently the last person to have read everything written in the English language. Since then, it's impossible. And I think a defining characteristic of the time we're in right now is there's more information than anybody can process. I mean, you and I are at the top of the cybersecurity field, and we both know we can't keep up with what's been done today in our own specialty. So what do you do? I think this whole reticence comes from all that risk. You're talking about it. It comes to a personal level. You know, every conversation you have with your boss is a job interview. You know, we all know that.
That's what I apparently didn't know.
Right? Explain so much. No, but I've had more than 30 of my own shows with Cybees, you know, talking about, you know, supply chain security, but really about transparency. Because I believe these systems we're building, you know, for cybersecurity, for supply chain security, and so forth, give us the structure where we can be transparent about the things we agreed in the first place.
All right. So there are so many things you've been talking about here. It triggered so many things in my head. First of all, so computers can still read essentially everything and solve that's been written and watch everything that's already been developed and recorded and do analysis on them. And one of the questions is, how do you apply that technology that, and AI is an overused word and it's used for machine learning and other stuff, but how do you use automation to address that challenge is one of the big ones. I don't think it's a lack of knowledge that causes people to be hesitant about what they say. I think people overestimate what they know. There are studies that have shown that people that are not really at the top level of expertise in their field have a tendency to believe they know more than they do. And people that are at the top of their field have a tendency to, let's say, recognize that they don't know as much as people think they know.
Sure. And, but everybody wants to be certain, right? And I think that, you know, I think what you're talking about itself is supported by the fact that it's hard to be certain of anything these days. You know, it's easy to find out information about anything, you know, in the time available to fill that time available.
The time available is sort of the critical thing here, right? Because, you know, one of the things that happens in research and in science, let's look at what you do, right? So, you know, you talk about what you do, but you're a scientist and a researcher. That's what you're doing, right? You're living in an experiment on life on the water. And it's not what anybody has ever done before. You know, you're an explorer just in the same way as a space explorer. And you're studying and measuring things, and you're living a life that is different than anybody else's life. And so part of that is, you know, you have a level of rigor that you really have to know what's going on in your boats or you'll be dead. I mean, you survived that big hurricane, the rest of Florida gets wiped out. And, you know, your boat just sort of sits there in the place that you know how to put it. And it's in shallow water and the right shadow of everything else. And no effect. You came back. The boat just worked, right?
And I could watch the cameras during the storm, too, and, you know, from safely on shore. Yeah, but again, the policy issues, right? You know, policy, uncertainty about policies and how they're enforced, you know, causes hesitancy everywhere. You know, personally, socially, demographically, economically, right? I really believe. I believe in, you know.
So let me ask you this question. Do you think the current global situation with the, I'll call it the war between autocracies and democracies, do you think that this is because autocracies don't have that hesitation because right or wrong, the people in charge of them have certainty that they're always right and they're just going to do what they do quickly and the democracies are slower to react because they are concerned about much more complex issues?
Well, yeah, you know, it's the you know, classic moral dilemma, you know, Humphrey Bogart, Sam Spade, right? You know, how do you, you know, the people who don't obey the law are restricted by it, you know, or the rules of anything, right? And we play that out on geopolitical scales. As
yeah, we're not going to talk politics, but we are going to talk.
And the you know, and again, the underlying plumbing of it, you know, I'm a huge believer in democracy, free speech, you know, free markets, you know, capitalism, right? You know, because it forces us to be honest. And I think honesty pays. And it doesn't necessarily mean that every day or every decade is always going to work. But I think over the long term, it does. And I see these trends in my main area of work in cybersecurity, where we're having to automate. You mentioned automation. How do we automate this? We have to automate, you know, companies and government entities, public and private, sharing information with massive consequences in huge scales. So I mentioned Samuel Coleridge, you know, in millions and millions and millions and millions of pieces of information every day, every minute, every second.
Well, but you're talking about the inevitability curve, right?
Right. We have to develop these systems to provide transparency and certainty for that. And
I don't necessarily buy into the inevitability of all the things you're saying. Some things I think you're right, they're inevitable. I mean, you know, yeah, they could not happen if a big meteor, you know, hits the earth, or if, you know, some other huge disaster happens, if we manage to kill ourselves or have a nuclear war. But other than that, a lot of the things you talk about, I believe, are reasonable. The medical space, one of the things we see about, you know, the living longer, happier, healthier, the positive view of cyber is that, you know, everything is better than it was 30 years ago. And people that claim it's not must not have lived 30 years ago or must have forgotten. You know, people live longer, healthier, happier lives. You know, we have, you know, vaccines that we showed up in 2 years. How long did it take to get the first influenza vaccine, you know, starting in 1919, right? So the world is changing for the better. And you see these companies that we talk to that are making changes in the world. And I love it that they're doing these changes in the world, and it's all positive, but I don't think that all of it's inevitable. I don't think that the unlimited surveillance society is inevitable. I don't believe that people are going to be unable over time to adapt to become a different species.
Right. If I understand what your point there, I agree. Right. You know, because it comes down to policy. And I think that, you know, in all my work, you know, so I'm working, you know, with fascinating people at the top of their games in supply chain security. And how do we do this? And I think I can see the technical means. I see the policy, the contract relationship level means. But transparency ends up being mechanical at the atomic level, right? You don't have to solve all the world's problems. You just have to say that if I'm entity A and I'm promising entity B I'll do things, being really, 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 really clear about that, really easy, is just better, faster, cheaper. It's always just better, faster, cheaper, because it saves time, energy, money, and everything else on both sides. And when
you're saying that,
of course, you have to get that transparency built in, the rest of us may be able to benefit from that, so that we can be a little more clear on the risks we all really actually face.
But you're saying that efficiency drives this, and I don't buy into human society as being driven by efficiency. I think that drives out the parts of human society that are the real underlying advantages of art and love and nature and the things that make life rich. And you're living a very rich life, and it's not because of efficiency. It's because of the joy in everything you do.
But I think efficiency, it's a rebound effect, right? You know, the efficiency of bronze over stone, you know, and steel over bronze and so forth was a technical thing. What people did with it was a different thing. And I think that's why I get enthusiastic about this. I think the transparency, the technical transparency we need to build into these systems for other reasons, you know, has a rebound effect on the rest of us. I think we have the opportunity to remove a layer of our fears and concerns just by being a little more clear.
A lot of it is developed because of and wasted because of war, right? I mean, so So yeah, war forces rapid development of all this technology, but it also is very destructive to humanity and all of the good things that we have. And this part of humanity that causes us to destroy ourselves and the other part of humanity that makes us so creative, somehow, you know, the cyber world has to come to become part of that and be realized by that, or people will not remain, you know, sort of the nature of the creatures that they can be. They won't be able to realize, you know, what you talk about as their better angels.
Well, you know, the conversation between the two of us, you know, I look at this entire thing evolving. And as I've told you before, you know, when I was a young man and just getting into this whole industry before I really, got into the firewall thing and security, there was a virus called the Good Times virus, and it took down the internet. And the internet was basically dial up in those days. And it just, everybody.
Well, it didn't take down the internet. It took down some portions of it.
Yeah. For our purposes here, right? You know, this is massive attack. And all it was an email that said, oh my God, there's an email called Good Times. Tell all your friends not to open it. So everybody sent it to all their friends, who sent it to all their friends. And then people started saying, don't send it to your friends anymore, which went to all their friends. And it was,
and that was the virus, right? The virus was induced by the environment of human beings, right?
And it was. I'm sitting in Mississauga, in Canada. If we hadn't met then, you're somewhere in the States. And I'm thinking to myself, no, and I was trying to argue on the internet that this is code in English text that is transmitted across the internet, displayed on my screen, goes to my optic nerve, executes in my brain, makes my fingers do things to propagate itself. That's right. A virus.
It's a viral influence operation. That's exactly right. It's now
we're into the disinformation world. And I've tried to frame this, where we are in the disinformation world, in the practical OT, you know, space, right? In the operational technology space, if we reach a point where the operator in a power facility doesn't really know whether or not the information he just got that said, I don't know, the city's on fire, they will take actions based on that. So the disinformation world we have right now,
the reliability and authenticity of information, things are screwed up badly. And this is, by the way, archives and records management studies reliability and authenticity of content, and that's the function of an archive. And if you look at the Inter-Pares Trust effort over the last 20 plus years out of University of British Columbia, that's been their focus. Reliable and authentic records are sort of fundamental to the survival of society, extending that into the day-to-day aspects of our cyber world, the information and the way we use it is fundamental to the survival of our societies.
Well, I've been at this long enough to see our acronym change from data processing to information technology and cybernetics and so on and so forth. I'm starting to see in this whole loop, it really is information. You know, the information, you know, is maybe transmitted electronically, maybe transmitted verbally. It doesn't make a difference. You know, the whole art has to encompass, you know, information as applied.
So information is the transmitted form, but cognitive mechanisms are the mechanism. So there's this combination of the information that's communicated across and within cognitive systems, and those cognitive systems and the overall cognitive systems of all of us combined, you know, that causes the future states of the world to change.
Well, that's right. You know, the marketing mechanisms, as you know, in 2008, I ran the rapid response team for the Obama campaign. And with 4,000 volunteer teams, you know, we worked in real time, you know, to bend, you know, the shared media narrative, you know, and I will state, I believe we did it honestly, trying to convince people of good arguments to see things a certain way, and journalists particularly who could amplify those. These days, so, you know, we have influencers and everything else. We understand that on the global media stage.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say,
Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. The latest spate of frauds being pushed out over social media follow historical patterns widely published in the deception space, but they might be new to you. One classic technique is to take an existing video or picture and relabel it with false information. This happened recently when a video showing Hamas shooting at Palestinians seeking to go south through the humanitarian corridor set up by the Israelis was made available on social media in near real time. Within hours, a Palestinian supporter relabeled the video and added text over top of it, along with the false claim that it was the Israeli soldiers shooting Palestinians as they went south through the humanitarian corridor. Within hours, a Hamas supporter relabeled the video and added text over top of it, along with the false claim that this was the Israeli soldiers shooting Palestinians as they went south through the humanitarian corridor. This sort of deception is standard practice in today's information warfare, and one of the reasons there is increasing pressure on the media to sort out the truth. At the same time, there are new technologies that support authentication and provenance demonstrations to assure that legitimate video and other content can be properly attributed to time and source. But these are rarely used and problematic under intentional deception methods. A key thing to understand many of these situations is to look carefully at the video, listen to what it says, listen to the sounds in the background, and observe the behavior of the people. In this particular case, you can see that people are waiting to enter an area, they're shooting, they're hesitating to go in, and then at some point later, they proceed inward and then proceed along their path towards the south, in this case. So what's clear from this, just by looking at the video, regardless of the labeling, is that these people are being shot at when they try to start going south, not as they're going south. And since the Israelis are the ones that are helping them go south, and the Palestinians are trying to go south, it seems obvious that the shooters can't be the Israelis, or else the Palestinians wouldn't continue to go south under their protection. Indeed, there are previous incidents where Hamas has demonstrably shot at people trying to go south through such corridors, and that's why the Israelis had to set up tanks and other methods of defense to assure that the people would not be accosted as they went south. There are also many reports from people, Palestinians, who have gone south, who said that the Hamas folks in the north were trying to stop them from going south. So clearly, this is a deception. On the other hand, it's very easy for people that want to believe it to look at it, believe it, and say there's another example. Criminal activity by the evil other side.
Another similar method of exploiting visuals with text is to take a picture that really tells nothing specific about what the text is about, and add text or voice over it to tell a story. The picture acts in the mind of the reader to make it seem real, even if the visual has nothing to do with the text. A third method being widely used is to create a from-scratch video, typically a close-up of someone in a room or some other place, making a hushed or rushed statement. It's essentially impossible to tell the truth from the fiction in these situations because there's inadequate context to perform consistency analysis between what is being said and the picture or video being shown.
Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. This segment is called How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it.
The techniques for video fakes like the ones I described are trivial to do. Download an existing video, use a free tool from over the internet, add text over top of it, save the result, and post it to your favorite video channel.
And that's how you do that. This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story.
Mark Menz was one of the early folks in digital forensics, working for law enforcement and for the public well-being, as well as on many private cases. Early in my forensics career, I encountered Mark, and I thought you'd be interested in some of the things that we've done throughout the course of our lives and some of the discussions we've had. Here's Mark.
Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about your testimony experience, because I believe you testified many more times than I did. So just give us a sense. How many times have you testified?
Hundreds, I'll say. It's been so many, between depositions, declarations, and courtroom, I'll have to say hundreds and hundreds of times. I've done work for a lot of different people. A lot of people in Hollywood, a lot of people, a lot of corporations, and then a lot of just law enforcement type cases as well.
So now you were in the HTCIA, the High Tech Crime Investigators Association, for a long time, right?
Yes, we were. Yep. Until they decided to kick us out, or at least five individuals did, to kick us out without following the bylaws of the company, organization. So
why did they decide to kick you out?
That could get me a lot of trouble because...
No, that's all right. No, nobody will know. There's only about a million listeners to the station. So.
They thought my brother had just got elected president of the organization for the second time. And this is what I was told, they thought we were going to be doing some audits and what have you. At least that's the story I heard. And they decided that they didn't want us in the organization anymore. I chalked it up to jealousy, but I don't know for sure. All I know is they went through this process and kicked us out on the last of December 31st at like 8 o'clock at night. So the reason why that's important was the board of directors for the organization on right after midnight on January 1st is a whole new group of people. So the older board of directors, the one that actually elected my brother to be president, were no longer there at that the next day. But they kicked us out, never cited any bylaws that said we were being kicked out. And only thing we could do at the time was sue in court and pay for our suing, the sue. The attorneys told us we would win hands down, but I didn't have that kind of money because I was in the middle of our patent lawsuit. So I had to let it go.
So now, you got kicked out, but I got never let in.
Oh, yeah, because you were a bad guy. That's right.
And what made me a bad guy?
Because you actually did work for people, the defense, on criminal cases.
I've now done it on three cases where the person being accused was innocent. But it doesn't matter whether they're innocent or not. What matters is if you ever worked for the defense, you couldn't get into the HTCIA at that time.
Right. They would not allow you in at that time. You were
now I was, what made that unhappy to me is, I was on their email list for many years. So I wasn't a member of the organization, but I was, communicating, answering people's questions, getting answers to my questions from other people in the forums. And my problem is that they sort of treat, let's say, they treat anybody that's not a member of the organization or that's not in law enforcement as an outsider in terms of giving them information. And to me, the legal system, at its fundamental, it should be fair. That is to say, no information available on one side should not be available to the other. And this seemed to me like what they were trying to do was exclude people that worked for defendants in criminal cases from having access to the same knowledge that the members of the organization had.
I know one of the things that bothered law enforcement people was on the law enforcement side, we provide all the information, everything, whether it convicts you or it's exculpatory, we have to present it.
Yeah, you're supposed to.
Whereas on the defense side, if there was convicting evidence that you found and we haven't found it yet, you didn't have to present that. So that was an uneven playing field. The rules didn't apply to both sides.
Yeah. Well, so the other side of that is that the prosecution has the high burden of proof, but they also have, the power of the state as opposed to the power of the individual. So it's intended to balance. But my perspective on it was never that I'm testifying for one side or another. I mean, I might be working for one side and I'll inform their attorney of the things that I understand and find and see and think. And the other side won't have, we'll say, access to that communication and that counsel. But when it comes to writing a report or testifying, I'm there to tell the truth. I'm there to tell the story of the evidence, of the digital evidence. I'm not there to take sides. I'm, you know, I try not to express opinions. I try to express conclusions along with the full basis for why it is I come to that conclusion. And I think that's the way forensics people should be, no matter what sort you're working on, right?
Absolutely. I've had cases where I had one criminal case where I was, the judge told me, hey, you have to work on this. Judge's right. order. You're going to work on it. Okay. That's fine. I work on the case and I'm going through the evidence and this guy is guilty as. So I sat down with him and his attorney and said, look, this is what we found. If I found it, they're going to find it at some point. So my recommendation was the best thing you can do at this point is probably, you know, look at maybe cutting a deal. Because when they find this, your deal will never, ever be as good. And defendant decided not to take that advice. He went from being able to maybe serve 7 years to serving 17. So
yeah, but 10 years is worth the bet, right?
I wouldn't take that bet.
Look, I don't want to get into too much into lawyers and lawyering and all that stuff.
Right, yeah. It's a quagmire.
But look, my experience with lawyers is every lawyer I've worked with, as far as I'm aware, is basically honest.
Absolutely. I've never had that problem with anybody.
Yeah, they don't lie. Now, they're representing their client, and their job is to do the best they can for their client. And they can't do what their client tells them not to do.
Right.
Right. So it's not really their fault, you know, that they're defending scum. Right. So that's a nice way to say it. But having said that, you know, plenty of criminal defendants are not that. Plenty of criminal defendants are, in fact, not guilty of the crime that they're being accused of. Nobody's perfect. I have no idea what else.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I look at things like you said, we're sitting there looking at, this is what we're looking for, and I've always been this way. I'm looking for what the truth is. Whichever side it falls on, doesn't matter. What matters is this is the truth. This is what we found. And that's really the focus of everything that I do.
Yeah, there's another saying. I love the sayings, right? This is the saying that, what is it? The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, shoot. Yeah.
I think you're the one that told me that. All right, so let's take a break here and we'll come back.
So the absence of evidence.
Evidence of absence, right?
There are so many of these sorts of sayings that come out of the legal world. And the Supreme Court has over time, seems to have the most impressive way of finding good ways of saying things, you know, that are expressive and meaningful. What's the, I don't remember the name of the Supreme Court justice, but I think the quote is something along the lines of, sunshine is the best disinfectant.
I don't put a name to it, but, you know, that's, you know, whoever is gets the credit because everybody knows that one. It's just true.
Brandeis made his famous statement that sunlight is said to be the best of disinfectants in a 1913 Harper's Weekly article entitled What Publicity Can Do.
Right. You know, and I frankly, I love the legal system, right? You know, I love open systems. And as we discussed in the last segment, there is nothing perfect. However, right, you know, of human systems to debate things out. You know, the modern American, you know, and, you know, the seemingly viable, you know, legal system of having democracies and courts where you can, and legislatures where you can set up laws and have people run through situations with them in front of human beings, judges, you know, and sometimes juries, you know, a group of people to say what sounds right. To say it again, say that one more time, right? You know, the 12 Angry Men, you know, great movie, you know, let's argue things out. Because, again, as we're saying in the last segment, right, you know, we live in a very quantum world, right? You know, an eyewitness was a great example in the public forum today, just recently. I can't remember where it came from. It may be a John Oliver reference anyways. But, you know, that eyewitness testimony is only worth so much. Yes, I saw it with my own eyes. However, I'm telling you about what I saw. You're not seeing it with your eyes. There's no way to bridge those two, right? And even if we have a camera, you're watching the video, you're not actually watching. You know, so laws and policy are how we thrash all this stuff out. So how that is working and not working tells you a lot about how the larger system of everything is working.
It's not what you think. It's not what the TV shows, right?
Right.
The TV shows these people working for the prosecution who are going right over the edge. You know, they're mad as hell about that, you know, bloody, you know, super. Yeah, no. Right. And you see the, you know, the other side of it is the videos we see of police officers that are doing horrible things to citizens, you know, for whatever reason. And it's, in my mind, very difficult to reconcile, because my experience with law enforcement being, you know, an old white male is, you know, that they've never been mean or nasty. You know, they're law enforcement. You know, if you lie to them, they don't like that, right? And furthermore, you know, they seem to be, you know, pretty smart about, let's say, various kinds of deception. So I got pulled over for speeding once. I was going for 30, you know, 40 in a 35 mile an hour zone or something like that. But he pulled me over and I was exhausted. You know, this was a long day. I was driving home and so forth. And he asked me, you know, when's the last time I got a ticket? And my answer was not a date. It was something else. And he was reasonable and asked me to clarify, you know, just for your clarity, what I asked you is, when is the last time? But, oh yeah. Okay. And I answered it. So he didn't treat it as I was trying to lie to him. He treated it as I didn't grok him. I didn't understand what he said, which is probably about right, because I was pretty exhausted. But just telling him the truth was good enough for him. And he said, okay, you know, so look, I realize it's, you know, 9 o'clock at night. There are no children in the children's area of the street, but the speed limit here is, you know, 30, whatever it is. And sent me on my way home. On another occasion, I was going, you know, 65 in a 50 mile an hour zone. The speed limit had changed and I didn't notice it, but I hadn't noticed much because I was about falling asleep as I'm driving on a 2-lane road, you know, going 15 miles an hour over the speed limit in one direction. And, you know, got pulled over and I thanked him. But I was actually very sincere about my appreciation. He gave me a ticket. That's fine. Because frankly, I would have fallen asleep and died, you know? So he's out there, you know, yeah, you know, I hate him. He gave me a ticket. No, I actually appreciate the fact that he, you know, probably saved me from killing myself and falling asleep on the road. And the ticket's a small price to pay. So you listen to Mark and his description and, you know, It is how everybody I know in the legal system works. You know, they're trying to do the best job they can. You know, people are paying them to do that job, but you know, the truth is the truth, right? I'm not gonna lie.
And it's, you know, comparing our paths, right? You know, it's been interesting as a lifelong hacker, right? You know, I was, you know, a hippie skateboard punk, you know, late '70s, early '80s, right? And, you know, getting into trouble and getting stopped by police, you know, for, you know, looking suspicious while walking. And in the 12th grade in Toronto, Canada, I went to an alternative education center, the Independent Education Center, INDEC. And I had an English class. And at the school, most of the classes were agreed between the student. The curriculum was agreed between the student and the instructor. And for this English class, they had a bunch of fun projects. One, to our point here, I spent the day with a notepad riding the subways of Toronto and walking around downtown. The first half of the day dressed like I would, and it was a very Robert Plant era, right? So long blonde hair, you know, hippie looking clothes, crazy jeans, you know, probably scarves hanging out of pockets, who knows what. And looking at people and writing about them, writing how they look at me or don't look at me and how they respond. And I had left in a locker, we still had lockers in subway stations back then, my one suit. So at noon, I went back and changed into the suit. I got all, you know, suit and tie, you know, clean dress, young man, and did the same thing, right? And recorded the different responses, right? And you map all this into, you know, legal systems, and just, I guess the lesson is don't be surprised, right? You know, I'm very self-aware, you know, and as you say, as a white guy, it's a funny little thing, right? I can put on or take off. You know, I can change my clothes, change the way I look, and be handled by, you know, all sorts of authorities, you know, entirely differently.
Which brings me to the course that I taught when I was at Sandia, teaching for University of New Haven on deception, fraud, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. And there was a student in that class who was a military guy. And, you know, he was like, you know, you give him tests, you show him the grade on the test. Here's the grade. You know, I was 90, 80, 70, right? So, well, you know, you have a 65, you're going to get a D. So, you know, he was unhappy about that. And he was, in his way, very expressive about that, feigning possible violence, I will say, but not explicit. So, but for all students, you know, you know, it doesn't matter. The deal is the deal. But they all had the opportunity for extra credit. And so I said, well, the way to, you know, it's points, right? You want to get another 20 points, go do extra credit. You know, you have an assignment out there. So the assignment, it's a course on deception, right? So the idea is to go out and do a deception, right? And something that demonstrates, you know, the principles of the thing. So he went out and to a park and dressed up, you know, stinky and wearing disgusting clothing and so forth. And he recounts the story, and he, you know, tried to get money from people and took good notes, supposedly, you know, okay, that's fine. So he comes back and he shows that to me, and I said, all right, I'll look at it. And so I read it. And when I read it, I came to two conclusions. The first conclusion was I didn't fully believe that he actually did it. I believe that he might have just written the report claiming to do it. And the second conclusion was it doesn't matter which one. If he wrote a report sufficiently convincing to make it unclear, then I had to say he did the deception reasonably well, right? The deception of the teacher. And if he actually executed the experiment, he did the deception reasonably well, the experiment. So one way or the other, he deserved, you know, the positive points that got him the better grade. Now, unless he's listening to the show, he never knew, you know, which one it was. So if he was lying to me, he probably thought he got away with something. But in fact, it's not that he got away with something. It's that he did a good enough job of lying in a deception course to demonstrate his capacity to do, you know, what the program says you're supposed to learn how to do. So I just, you know, it's so bizarre to many people that when you're taking a course about lying that you're allowed to lie. But that's the course. That's the proof you know what you're doing. So I just thought I would share that the same way as you shared yours.
Let me end on a up note, because it did have me think about this. And one of the things I did that afternoon, I was downtown Toronto, Union Station, and I bought a dozen red roses from a flower vendor, flower lady, and I gave them away individually to different women that I saw around, you know, and I wrote about each of them. And I remember one, a lady crossing this, trying to walk across the street and looking entirely frazzled, just stopping and, you know, presenting a rose, smiling and walking away. Right.
Very nice.
And, you know, so it's a, you know, to our point, you know, life is for the living. Right. You know, while you're in the middle of doing things, you know, whether you're, you know, doing a deception experiment or whatever it is you're doing, you know, look at, you know, we have too much of a focus on the negative side. In the security world, in the cyber world, you can't get any worse, a bunch of folks, because we're like the police. You know, we see the worst things happening all the time and spend a lot of time looking at that. But most things are people giving out flowers for an English project, because why not?
It pays to be nice.
We'll be telling more stories from Cyber Cops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co.
We're having discussions with Joe Weiss. Joe is an old school control systems guy who worked on control systems for the first half of his career and ended up in cybersecurity by accident, as usual.
We're back with Joe, and we're going to move forward in time. So after your time at EPRI, then what did you do?
Okay, let me just finish this, okay?
No, don't finish this. Let's go on to your time after EPRI.
When you're talking about, because this is the cyber journey. So I left nuclear and went to Fossil to run the Fossil Plant Instrumentation Controls Program. In the 95 or so time frame, maybe 96, I had the head of IT from EPRI come to me asking for me to address cybersecurity.
Out of the blue.
Out of the blue.
Because you knew nothing about computers other than the control systems, and why not choose you?
Well, that was exactly what my question is. What do we care about email?
Oh, well, and you learn. Understand.
This was our view in the middle 90s. In fact, unfortunately, to this day, this is the view of many, 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 many people in the control system world.
That's half of the problem, Joe, because the other half of the problem is that in the IT world, they say, why do I care about those control mechanisms?
Absolutely. It's like, both.
Why do I care if that packet gets there 2 milliseconds later? And the control people are saying, 2 milliseconds? I have 47 nanoseconds to respond to this.
That's
thing.
Right. You see that plant? It's in rubble if you do that. Okay. Now,
right. So this misunderstanding between the fields is a huge problem. And, you know, I was pointing this out in that same time frame for those same reasons. And it still isn't fixed. So
it's getting worse. It's not getting better. It is getting unbelievably worse.
Well, there's a combination of misperception and a lack of education and so on and so forth.
Exactly.
And we're going to get up to the modern day in a minute. But I met you, it was probably the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And you were starting to talk about the, you know, cyber digital system.
That would have been in the early 2000s because, let me just finish this, okay? In the, around 97, 98, I had a bunch of friends coming to me saying that they had IBM crawling all through their facilities and they couldn't spell the word pneumatic. And they were trying to tell them what to do. That was the genesis of the Y2K embedded systems program, of which I became the technical lead. So here we were from 97 or 98 to 2000. And we had all of these utilities and other companies all over the world worried about the embedded Y2K program because of the clocks, which is really an unintentional cyber issue. Okay.
So in that time frame, Joe, I was at Sandia National Laboratories, also working on the Y2K issues. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we did studies of the power infrastructure for that.
Right.
And you're going to love this. One of the things we identified, I actually identified this in looking at the power grid writ large, was that the same problem with these sympathetic vibrations could cause large-scale problems across the grid and destroy the equipment. And it could be systematically imposed by external whatever. At the time, that was classified, but it was subsequently revealed by others. But it's the same problem.
Yes, it's the same problem.
And we've known about it for hundreds of years, right?
And
we just can't figure out from, you know, every generation has to do it again. I'm convinced that it's not going to change.
I agree with you.
Every engineer has to personally have something fail before they'll say, I better think about that.
So that's why I wanted to finish this before I get to 2000, okay? So the point being, we're doing all of this stuff for Y2K. It's all related to clocks. The word cyber has never come up, okay? Nobody is looking at this as being cyber. Everybody's looking at this as being, you know, COBOL, but it's really the clocks, because the clocks, you know, the software was all based on when it gets to 2000, it either stops or rolls back to something or other. So one of the things I did is we had it turns out that one of the utilities in Canada, Edmonton, I think is one of the largest big cities north in the world. And this is TransAlta, okay? So TransAlta was the leader, or one of the leaders, I should say, in the EPRI Y2K Embedded Systems Program. Because you're talking about January in Edmonton, and people are going to die if...
Well, people die in the northeastern United States, too.
I'm just saying, but TransAlta really, really got it. So we ended up taking one of their coal-fired power plants. And we did, I got all of these people from all over the world, you know, our vendors, everybody, because at that point in time, the vendors were saying, well, all of my controls and all of my equipment, that's all proprietary. So I said, fine, you come and you worry about your piece. And the whole purpose of this is we rolled over this 300 megawatt coal-fired power plant to find out what happens when all of those clocks reach zero. And it turns out nothing really bad happened, which is why we were pretty confident we weren't looking at Armageddon, okay? Because we did the test. What happened then? Now, there's one other thing that also goes about this whole culture issue. With Y2K, everybody knew precisely when the end was, okay? It was at midnight 2000, this, you know, January 1, 2000. It turns out that the government ended up putting certain requirements out there. And what was really funny is the EPRI and utility and all of the rest of the lawyers came together and said, because Scott Adams with Dilbert had run cartoons on Y2K, the lawyers basically said, honest to God, that because Dilbert is read, you know, so widely.
Yeah, everybody knows this, so you'd better fix it, because if that happens, you can't say nobody knew.
Now, and that became the Dilbert date, literally. And from that time on, nobody could claim they didn't know. Fred, you're exactly right. Well, the point here was that the government requirements, and this was unique, had basically said that officers and directors would be personally liable during Y2K, which is why all of the companies, for the first and only time today, got everybody together and all of these walls between organizations came down, because the officers and directors weren't about to go to jail. Now, that was also why we started the Control System Cyber Program at EPRI.
Because of Dilbert cartoons.
Because Dilbert got the utilities to realize they had to work together. We mistakenly thought, that that situation with all of the walls down would continue. And so when we started the EPRI Control System Cyber Program, it was based on the fact that the information sharing would continue. We, Fred, I didn't know about you when we started this. I didn't know about anything about cyber.
I know that. In fact, in those early days, when you started to talk about this stuff, that's really when I encountered you, when you were starting to talk about this.
Yeah.
And of course, you were seeing it from one side, where those IT people were coming in, you know, screwing up the cyber. And I was seeing it from both sides, because I've been sitting on both sides. And
absolutely.
And the IT people, you know, they already had their own problems. They were going to bring all those problems to you.
Absolutely. So that I'm trying to lay out, here is where this came from. And also, honestly, if I would have known the politics and the culture and everything, I would have never, ever, ever started that EPRI program. This was supposed to have been a technical program. It was supposed to have been.
Yeah, there is no such thing.
No, only I was naive and never thought about it. I was thinking, you know, how can trying to keep lights on and water flowing be political or be culturally divisive or anything, okay? Yeah. I just never thought about that.
Yeah, so, never occurred to you.
No.
Somebody would want the lights to go out. Because you said
what the issue is.
And it's not that they don't want the lights to stay on. It's that they don't want to do the stuff that's required.
Or they want somebody else doing it for them. Okay. So
yeah.
Anyways, the point being, and you know, this is what led to 2000 and the start of the EPRI control system cyber program. And the people I were working with at Sandia, it wasn't you, but it was like Rolf Carlson and Juan Torres, who's now at NREL. It were, you know, those people there. And I was working with, at the time, Jeff Daigle, like at PNNL, and I forgot who at Argon, but at that point in time, Idaho wasn't involved at all.
Yeah, you know, they turned out ultimately to be very important in that. But I want to.
I know they did. I helped them start that. Okay.
Okay, Chris, the Dilbert date.
The Dilbert date. It is amazing.
When you talk about how the world works, Joe's like, I had no idea the world worked this way. But the reason it worked was because of Dilbert, the comedy.
Well, and it's you know, as the decades pile up, right, you know, and the patterns reemerge. I know I've said this on the show before, but John Alsop, 1990, you know, one or two, well, whatever, yeah, 92, I think it was, we were building Borderware firewall. Somebody told me there's not enough IP address, network address translation, the NAT, the 192.168, you know, everybody knows about, you know, you see on your home computers, hadn't been figured out. And I freaked out. I ran into his office and he said, anytime there's a big enough barrier, somebody comes, big enough demand, and there's a technical barrier, somebody will fix it. And I've just seen it over and over and over and over again. And in this era of my career, and doing these shows with you and all the other conversations and podcasts and so forth, and looking, you know, talking with, you know, long-term friends like Joe, who've been at this from so many different perspectives for so many years, there are just times for things. Stuxnet, you know, in 2010, you know, it was found that, you know, someone had gotten malware into an Iranian nuclear facility and basically taken their nuclear weapons program offline for 2 or 3 years in interesting ways. I remember at the time, you know, the U.S. was accused of being the author of that, and which I think subsequently is a popular view. And a French La Presse journalist was interviewed me and was trying to get me to say that the Americans were living in a glass house throwing stones. And all I could think of was, it's that time. You know, it doesn't really matter who does something first sometimes, because it's Stuxnet time. It's time that, you know, people are going to be using these means to achieve ends that people are achieving already. And if you didn't see them coming, you're not paying attention. Right. Yeah. And they, you know, with Joe, right. Yeah. We've had these conversations as well over the years. It's like, we're at this point. It's like, here we go.
I think the same thing is true about computer viruses. I view, you know, when I looked at that afterwards, when I was there, you know, doing it, it was like, oh, of course. Right. I mean, it was the proverbial light bulb turning up above my head. But at the end of the day, it's a concept whose time had come. And it's reasonable to say that it's inevitable that that would happen, right? And part of the reason is it's just the conditions of the world. And
right. You know, in both cases, you know, with computer viruses and your original work on that, you know, again, I think that was sort of specific. You know, with network address translation, it was again, me and two other different, you know, me and two folks and two other groups independently, completely, almost the exact same time, did the same thing. Now, in our case, maybe it wouldn't have been network address translation using ports and tables and so forth, but it was going to be something. You know, you can just count on that.
Right. So it's an interesting theory, right? And so one of the problems is that's what drives people towards not worrying about things like climate change. And, you know, so they keep going further and further, and they say, well, technology will solve it. And there are certain things technology cannot solve. And they don't seem to recognize that. And so usually what we see is not just a technical solution, right? It's a governance solution. And where technology plays a role, that's great. So just very recently, I mean, very, very recently, the President of the United States has announced this new program for AI. Essentially regulatory scheme to start controlling AI. And if you look at that scheme, and I haven't looked in detail yet, but the content in it's pretty interesting. It includes AI being used for deceptions and frauds, and asserts essentially that the regulatory scheme has to make it so you can't deploy AI if it can be used for that purpose. OMG. Right. That's a wonderful concept, but oh my goodness, they have no clue what they're asking for.
Yeah, in the real world, it's not going to work that way, right? And there are breaking points. I worry about that with my own optimistic view of things, you know, and the fact that, you know, my, you know, increasingly long life keeps proving me right over and over and over again. But the climate change issue and environmental issues, you can push things past tipping points. And, you know, I worry more about these all of these issues, you know, critical sort of long-term species survival issues and so forth, more about disinformation than anything else. Because that's when governance goes out the window, when you have, you know, a population, local or global, you know, that can't agree on, you know, the color of blue.
Which brings us to the movie Don't Look Up.
I haven't watched that one, actually. I know of it, yes.
Oh, well, so that's it, Chris. You have to watch it to keep up with the show.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
Well, we should watch it anyway, but I just want to remind everybody I am not getting a fee for having said that. I'm just saying. If I was getting a fee, I would probably have said it months ago. Another thing that hit me, you know, in Joe's conversation is this Y2K thing. And, you know, he talks about the different roles that different people played. And, you know, in that space, it was very interesting to me because, as I said, I was working for Sandia National Laboratories at the time. And so I got invited to a meeting in Washington, D.C. And the meeting in Washington, D.C., it had something international involved. And for one reason or another, the meeting I got involved in that had to do with global military and operations and all these things, it ended up that because I was going to that meeting, I got briefed on the actual Y2K situation with regard to U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal. And I was authorized to communicate on behalf of Sandia National Laboratories, which was the engineering laboratory, still is, for all nuclear weapons. So I was actually authorized to make the truthful statements about the situation with regard to Y2K and nuclear weapons, which to me is like the most bizarre thing of all. You know, I happened to be going there. They decided that, you know, this was important enough for that group to know. And since I was going there, I was going to do the briefing. And so they briefed me. And I'll tell you what the answer is. It's really simple. There is nothing related to dates and times in any U.S. nuclear weapon. That was the briefing. That's it. It's just, there's nothing in any of those weapons that cares about the date at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Which is, I suppose, good and potentially bad, right? You know, maybe that's a control you'd want to put on weapons like those. But, you know, interesting to know.
And as it happens, I think partly because of a side effect of that, and another meeting I went to that had to do, later meeting I went to, I ended up briefing the State Department before Y2K at their Y2K preparation meetings on what to do related to Y2K. And at that point, there was no certainty about it. So my briefing to the State Department and their global community was that they should make friends.
Right?
Make friends. If that's what goes wrong, you want to make sure you have friends, local friends, and, you know, go over to, you know, bring wine.
Right.
You know, bring some matches in case you need to start a fire. Go find a friend, go to their house. I mean, you know, because and that was the actual briefing that went out. I mean, I put it in more words, but that's basically what I said. So, okay. Well, we're going to stop this recording before it gets really crazy.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Mark coins the phrase and I steal it for years. Joe talks divergence, IoT, OT, IT divergence, ELN starts a new thing, more fraud, spies, and lies from the war front, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.